Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A resurgence of bubonic plague in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is putting young lives at risk, the UN Children's Fund UNICEF has warned. Poverty, conflict and displacement are contributing to the return of the illness for the first time in more than a decade, and new research supported by the agency revealed that children are especially vulnerable. The research focused on three health zones in Ituri province, where more than 490 cases were recorded between 2020 and 2021, with 20 fatalities. Some 578 cases and 44 plague-related deaths occurred throughout the entire province during the same period. Bubonic plague, also known as the Black Death, is an infectious disease caused by a bacteria usually found in small mammals and their fleas. It's characterized by painful, swollen lymph nodes. Although the disease is easily treatable with antibiotics, which are available in most health zones in Ituri, UNICEF stressed that it's important to seek treatment quickly. The agency is appealing for support to assist affected communities in Ituri, including through a rat and flea eradication campaign and the construction of homes that are more resistant to them. Finding solutions based on peace and development is crucial for the future of the nearly 7 million forcibly displaced people from Sudan and South Sudan, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said following a three-day visit to the two countries. During the trip, Mr. Grandi met Sudan's Prime Minister, Abdalla Hamdok, and South Sudan's President, Salva Kiir, where they discussed how the two countries can work together to help their displaced populations. Returning home is one solution, but it's not the only one, the High Commissioner said. If someone chooses to remain displaced, the initiative must ensure that they can do so with dignity and sense of belonging. Concluding his visit, Mr. Grandi urged continued support for the revitalized peace agreement signed in 2018, aimed at finding lasting solutions for refugees, internally displaced people, returnees and host communities. This initiative is a unique opportunity to place the respective governments and displaced people at the center of planning for the future, and so it will require concerted efforts to ensure their sustained stability and security, he said. The vast majority of people with high blood pressure or hypertension live in low- and middle-income countries, a World Health Organization report released on Wednesday has revealed. The study, which was co-led by Imperial College London, found that this amounts to 82% of people with hypertension, or around 1 billion people. The researchers found that Canada, Peru and Switzerland had among the lowest prevalence of hypertension in the world in 2019, while some of the highest rates were seen in the Dominican Republic, Jamaica and Paraguay for women, and Hungary, Paraguay and Poland for men. The study also revealed significant gaps in diagnosis and treatment. About 580 million people with hypertension were unaware of their condition because they were never diagnosed. The study also indicated that more than half of the people with hypertension, or a total of 720 million individuals, were not receiving the treatment that they needed. As hypertension is easy to diagnose and treat with low-cost medicines, Professor Majid Azati, senior author of the study, called it a public health failure. In parallel with the report, the World Health Organization launched the first new guideline in 20 years on the treatment of hypertension to help countries improve their management of the disease. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about my new book, I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 other myths about surveillance and privacy.
We get a chance to interview our co-host, Heidi Boghossian, who has just written, I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 other myths about surveillance and privacy. It's a great contribution to the movement.
Attorney Marjorie Cohn joins us in our ongoing coverage of the case of Julian Assange.
The U.S. government wants to get its hands on Julian and silence him for the rest of his life. No law stands in their way. They've got complicity with several governments around the world, and they're going to get him and kill him if they can.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Should we give up our privacy altogether because we think we have nothing to hide? This is perhaps the most pervasive of the myths about surveillance and privacy that Heidi Boghossian explores in her new work, I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. Other popular misconceptions detailed in the book include the notions that surveillance makes the nation safer. No one wants to spy on children. Police don't monitor social media. Metadata doesn't reveal much about me. Congress and the courts protect us from surveillance, and there's nothing I can do to stop surveillance anyway. Privacy is a fundamental right, and one that we often take for granted in the digital era. In her new book from Beacon Press, Heidi debunks some of the reasons these myths have evolved and why we unquestionably believe them. She warns us of the dangers they present to our freedoms and suggests ways to protect ourselves from the government and corporations that purport to protect us and serve us. Today we're going to speak with our co-host on Law and Disorder, Heidi Boghossian, about her new book. We're offering it as a gift to supporters of our program and supporters of WBAI. It's available to you for $50. That's the gift we'll give you for giving to the station. Please call 212-209-2950. Well, Heidi, we're going to turn the tables on you. You're not only my co-host, but you're also the subject of this interview because you've written a terrific book called I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. And let's talk about the book, Heidi. I want to congratulate you. You really did a good job. Why
Thank
the title,
you.
I've Got Nothing to Hide? You're very welcome. Why the title, I've Got Nothing to Hide, and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy? Do people really not get it? Do they really think they've got nothing to fear?
Michael, this is one of the most frequently heard myths when the topic of surveillance arises. I think it's a variation of the larger tensions between individual rights and national security. So those who say they have nothing to hide seem to be oblivious to the dangers that omnipresent surveillance poses to our individual liberties. Once we turn on the faucet for mass monitoring, it's not something we can easily turn back off. I think it's a rather facile response by individuals who often see the world in black and white, rather than in the nuanced gray tones that we live with. First, privacy is critical to our daily lives and also to society's smooth functioning. Public health, public welfare all depend on affording various levels of privacy. For example, to individuals who may be clinically depressed and contemplating suicide. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline, as our listeners probably know, lets callers be anonymous, and it receives somewhere between 2 million calls annually, which no doubt are saving many lives. The same goes for keeping things like HIV status private. People may be discouraged from getting tested if they have to give their name, so testing can now be done confidentially or anonymously. But Michael, think about whistleblowers. We rely on anonymous tips to report official malfeasance, waste, abuse. The government in many states have hotlines where you can share tips anonymously. And in New York City, for example, we have a Crime Stoppers hotline that doesn't trace or record calls or ask for names. I think in a larger sense, everyone needs privacy to remain autonomous. And that means we get to decide what and when we reveal information about ourselves that we want to keep private to others. It's a choice. I think finally, people who believe this myth have blind faith in state and corporate powers. But we especially on Law and Disorder have seen how federal agencies and their corporate partners cannot be trusted to operate in good faith. They have a lackluster track record in safeguarding our personal data from hackers. That's often because they don't take adequate measures to protect it in their databases. So massive data breaches have exposed millions of individuals unnecessarily have exposed their private data, which then opens them up to fraud and identity theft. My takeaway for this myth is that people who adhere to it greatly underestimate the repressive power of the all-seeing state.
We're talking to our own Heidi Boghossian. For those of you that have tuned in late, we're talking about Heidi's new book. It's called I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Our Surveillance and Privacy. Heidi, before I tell people how they can get the book, I wanted to ask you one follow-up question. Please tell us about the nature and the extent of surveillance by the government and corporations and our lack of privacy. How widespread is this?
Well, the Washington Post did an investigation a few years back that revealed that nearly 2,000 private security companies and over 1,200 government organizations or agencies engage in counterterrorism intelligence gathering. Now, that was several years ago, so I'm sure those numbers have greatly expanded. We also know that corporations who may not be solely in the practice of counterterrorism intelligence gathering often have their own security arms where, with activists, for example, who may be critical of their policies, they have engaged in surveillance, monitoring, and in certain circumstances, even infiltrating activist organizations. I think SeaWorld a couple of years ago was infiltrated to spy on people and often subvert the investigations that these groups are trying to uncover. So it's a massive operation, and people should know that we learned with Ed Snowden revelations that something like 80% of our government intelligence is outsourced to private security companies. The problem, as you know, Michael, is that they don't have to abide by the strictures of the U.S. Constitution. So they're not looking out for our interests to the extent that our government, when it does so.
Heidi, do you think that surveillance makes us safer?
Most definitely not. This is one of the more popular myths. It comes up every time there's a criminal attack or some kind of national security event where the public starts to get on edge. The government uses it to frighten the public into accepting widespread and pervasive spying. But Michael, I cite an unlikely source because I thought it was so compelling, and that is the U.S. Army War College. Because in one of the reports that they wrote, here's a short quote from it, they say, U.S. efforts in the war on terror have been largely ineffective in achieving the stated objectives. Their report also says there's no proof that those people who claim that because another attack like 9/11 hasn't happened, well, that's proof that the war on terror has been a success. I think this is a handy line that the government doles out to encourage people to not mind giving up their personal privacy, their civil liberties, because they think, well, I'm doing this to make our nation safer. And there's no evidence. I cite some other sources, but there's absolutely no evidence that it has made any impact in making us safer. And I also think we need to underscore the fact that you do not have to give up civil liberties in order to have national security. We can strike a balance. It's not one or the other.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things that you write about in your book, Heidi. In I Have Nothing to Hide, you talk about police monitoring social media, and you talk about biometric technology so that they have face recognition technology that can tell who we are. Talk about the police on social media, and they're using biotechnology and biometrics.
Well, police monitoring social media is, when you really think about it, a very cost-effective and relatively easy way for law enforcement to follow certain individuals or groups of people to look for what they are going to say are tips that criminal activity may be afoot. It's easy because many people don't set the privacy settings on their accounts so a lot of people can go on and read them. Now, the problem with this is because we communicate so very differently on social media, informally, with colloquial language, shorthand, slang, law enforcement can easily misinterpret the things that are posted there. Not only can they misinterpret them, but if they really want to open investigation, they can sort of position sayings like that either by taking part of a quotation, part of a text, and using it in a way that fits with their agenda, thus enabling them to open an investigation. Now, Michael, you may remember that several years ago in the Bronx, in a public housing project, police monitored social media of teenagers who were friends with each other, and they lived in the same building or set of buildings right near each other. So they hung out together. Police monitored their social media and then went in and raided 100 or so of them and arrested these kids on racketeering, RICO charges, traditionally used, as you know, for, you know, organized crime. And they arrested them, I think, on drug-related charges, when in fact most of the kids were just communicating through social media with their neighbors and friends. And the problem with that is that a lot of these kids couldn't afford defense attorneys, and many of them did get, as I recall, public defenders. But RICO charges are notoriously difficult to prosecute. So what happened was you had a guilt by association situation stemming initially from culling social media and then using it to fit the larger RICO charges, which really devastated and ruined the lives, not only of many of these kids who were run through the criminal justice system for often years at a time, but their families and communities. That's just one example of how misinterpreting communications on social media by third parties who don't really know who these people are can have disastrous consequences. And in terms of biometrics, as you mentioned, biometric identification, as we've covered on Law and Disorder, we interviewed Claire Garvey from Georgetown University. Biometrics use physical or behavioral characteristics that are unique to an individual human being to authenticate that person's identity. So I could take, if I were a cop, for example, your finger or palm print, or Michael, your iris or retina scan, even your ear print, your heartbeat, your facial recognition, your DNA, or your brain waves, and put those in the database and retrieve them whenever I want to. And as we covered in that segment that we did, and I encourage listeners to pull up Claire Garvey because she's so intelligent on this and one of the leading experts in the country, something like half of the country, the faces of half of our populace are stored in police databases already. They get them from public cameras all over, you know, mugshots, social media, other places. Now, behavioral biometrics, on the other hand, are things like our voice, our gait, even our eye blinking and speech patterns, how we hold the grip on a steering wheel, our signatures, even how we type on a computer. None of these are foolproof by any means, but they are growing in use. And I think that the myth here is many people believe they're foolproof. They can be hacked, the databases that they're in the chapter that I have on biometrics. I start with an example of researchers who made face masks from facial imprints. They use those masks in different airports and places around the world, and they tricked the cameras that read the biometric identification. So they're not foolproof, and I suggest, as others have, that if biometrics are going to be used, to be safe, they must, and to be accurate, they must be paired with another form of identification or authentication. But the fact is, they can be altered, they can be stolen from photos, and once they're hacked or stolen, this is the one part of our identification that you can't replace like a password. So it's all the more reason they need to be highly protected if they're even going to be used.
Yeah, it's plenty creepy. It struck me, I went to the cardiologist last year, and I was driving home from the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, and they take a picture of you when you drive through the tunnel. And it dawned on me that the cops are going to know more about the condition of my heart than I do. And before I even get home, they're going to know all of that. So it's scary.
I'm sure the last time you went to the hospital for some kind of checkup or test, I know that I was offered, I think it was at New York Hospital, the option of signing in person or using a handprint, I think it was. And they've been doing this for a couple of years, right? I hope you didn't pick the handprint.
I resisted, and the doctor said, don't give them a hard time. And I said, but this is me, and I don't want to do it.
And that goes to the heart of what we're faced with. We're facing increasingly a trade-off between convenience, expedience, and personal security. I know that you're curious about whether our phones can spy on us, and of course the answer is yes. But we've gotten so used to using our phones for everything that we do during the day and carrying them in our pockets. But they're perfect surveillance devices, and I think the problem is when these biometric technologies start seeping into everyday places like hospitals or businesses, banks, they have to give us an option to opt out of that, I hope, because otherwise we're totally connected to the surveillance apparatus.
Let me just inform our listeners about one of your fans, Allison Macrina, who's the director of the Library Freedom Project. We had her on as a guest, and she says about your book, "The first time I opened this book, I audibly squealed in delight. The persistent privacy myths that Boghossian exposes are the torment of every privacy advocate's existence. She eviscerates each one with style, melding important tech and policy history with personal stories and current events. This book is for anyone who wants to lay to rest the most persistent and damaging myth that we should give up our privacy altogether." Allison Macrina. Congratulations, Heidi, to elicit a blurb on the back of your book from somebody that prestigious is really laudatory.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Let's talk about not just cell phones, but the other gadgets that people have in their home, like Alexa. What can those things do to us?
Okay, don't get me started on the evil Alexa, Michael. She is my enemy. But before we talk about smart homes that include things like Alexa, I want to just add on the topic of Allison, when we interviewed her several years ago, and I have a chapter in my book on this topic, one of the things we discussed was a small library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, which happens to be just a few miles from the town in New Hampshire where I grew up, Hanover. They installed in their library Tor, it's called the Onion Router, and it's what many people will know as software that anonymizes your search activities online. And Chuck McAndrew, who I quote in the book and tell his story, came to that library several years ago, and that was one of the first things that he did to ensure that patrons who are surfing the web are able to do so without anyone being government actors or corporate entities, being able to search what people had looked for online. And I give the example for teenagers who are maybe curious about sex or, you know, like venereal diseases or embarrassing topics. They you know, may not want to ask a friend or haven't yet asked their parents, they can go online and look for it. Well, they don't want to have that a trail left of what they've been investigating online. And what happened was after Chuck installed this at Kilton Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, the Department of Homeland Security got wind of it. And they came up and paid Chuck and his boss a visit and said their usual line of, do you want to grease the wheels of lawlessness? Because, as you know, Michael, we've covered this a lot in discussions about hackers and Julian Assange, whistleblowers who use anonymizing software like Tor or SecureDrop. The government likes to portray anonymizing tools, even though they were the original creators of it, as shady characters dealing on the dark web who were trying to engage in illegal activity, when in fact that's very far from the truth. So they frightened the administrators at the library, and the board of trustees caved and removed Tor. But then there was great community outrage. People were protesting on the lawn, and Vermonters and New Hampshireites, you know, converged, and they reinstated Tor. Now, this sounds like a really small measure, and it was certainly a small library where this happened, but it was a huge victory for recognizing that this nation has a history of appreciating the ability to engage in anonymous speech. And I just say bravo to Allison and the Library Freedom Project supported Chuck McAndrew and that library, and kudos to their work.
Let me get to a heavy question here. What can we do to take action and demand that federal agencies and corporations guard our privacy and help reclaim control of our data?
Michael, it's not an easy question to answer. I want to first say that we need to raise general awareness of how the government with corporations really are a double-headed hydra when it comes to surveillance. In the book, I call corporations butlers to the billionaires. They really perform the dirty work of the 1%. They help maintain power among the richest and the most privileged in our society. As we mentioned, our intelligence is outsourced to private contractors, and personal data is the new commodity. It's more valuable than oil. That means every corporation is out to get your personal data. They aggregate it, they resell it to others, to marketers, and then ads are directed at you. As you know, when you're online and you search for a pair of shoes, all of a sudden you have shoes coming at you from all angles. People need to know that if you don't start being discerning about your privacy settings, how you handle your own electronic hygiene, you're stashing your crown jewels in a cheap motel safe, and you're leaving the code on a post-it in plain sight.
How does this impact democracy, and do people really act differently if they know they're being spied on?
Well, yes. I cite several studies, many of them in Great Britain, that show that when we know we're being watched, and it doesn't have to be high-tech surveillance, something as simple as a poster that has two large eyes, even just drawn onto it, in one study was posted in a coffee room at a university in Great Britain where they had the honor system. So you could make your coffee and then leave money in the pot. And when they posted a sign with two large eyes on it looking directly at you as you face the coffee pot, they found that people left more money. They alternated weeks and put a bowl of flowers on the sign. And on the flower weeks, people tended to be less generous with their donations. Another interesting study was with kids who were trick-or-treating, where mirrors were put up in half of the trick-or-treaters' houses. and they left bowls of candy in front of the mirrors, and there were no people guarding them, so kids could open the door. And of course, in the ones without mirrors, they took handfuls of candy, but in the homes where they knew that they were being reflected in a mirror, not necessarily watched, they felt guilty, and they curbed their enthusiasm, as it were, and took less candy. Now, there have also been other studies, especially after the events of 9/11, after the Edward Snowden revelations, that monitor how people communicate on social media. And when people have increased awareness, for example, that the NSA may be gathering their data, their metadata, they change their language. They don't use trigger words like bomb or attacks or other words that might raise suspicion.
I thank you very much for your great work on the book, and thank you for the interview.
Michael, thank you so much for reading my book and for taking the time to have me on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Julian Assange case is the most important civil liberties, First Amendment, freedom to write, freedom to learn case of our times. Democracy cannot thrive without a free press that watches over the government and tells the truth. The government wants secrecy. We need transparency. Julian Assange was a young Australian computer genius when he figured out a way for whistleblowers to reveal truths of government corruption, duplicity, and war crimes. Whistleblowers could report these things with anonymity. The great Australian journalist John Pilger describes Julian Assange's accomplishments. WikiLeaks, of which Assange is founder and publisher, exposed the secrets and lies that led to the invasion of Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, the murderous role of the Pentagon in dozens of countries, the blueprint for the 20-year catastrophe in Afghanistan, the attempts by Washington to overthrow elected governments such as Venezuela's, the collusion between nominal political opponents, Bush and Obama, and the CIA vault campaign that turned your mobile phone, even your TV, into a spy in your own midst. And there's much more. The government soon realized Julian Assange had to be crushed and silenced. Years ago, the Department of Defense issued orders to smear his name. He was falsely accused of everything from rape to abusing his pet cat. Their smear campaign was largely effective, with many leftists and liberals now giving only lukewarm support to Julian Assange, who sits in solitary in Britain's infamous Belmarsh prison, awaiting extradition to a court in Eastern Virginia, which will certainly convict him and imprison him for the rest of his life. He faces charges of spying under the 1917 Espionage Act, which was never intended to be used against journalists, but is now used regularly against whistleblowers. He's in terrible physical and psychological shape. A lower court judge in Great Britain recently ruled that it's likely that he will commit suicide and refused America's request to extradite him to Virginia. But an appeals court in Britain wants to take another look at the lower court's evaluation. A hearing is scheduled for October 27th. We speak today with attorney Marjorie Cohn, who's a retired law professor from the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. She's a past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a regular columnist in the online magazine Truthout, where she has a recent column on Julian Assange. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Marjorie, before I ask you about the details of the latest court ruling, which you've just written about in your Truthout column, I wanted to ask you about what Julian has done and why does the United States fear his journalism and publishing?
Well, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks had the gall to publish evidence of war crimes committed by the United States, and that is just intolerable to the government. In 2010 and 2011, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes the U.S. military had committed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo, and that included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq War, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and evidence of systematic torture, murder, and rape after U.S. forces handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks also published the Afghan war logs, 90,000 reports about the war in Afghanistan, which revealed more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to. And they published the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports showing that 150 innocent people had been imprisoned there for years, and documented the U.S. government's torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. But the most notable, and I should say infamous, release by WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video depicting a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship in Baghdad target and fire at unarmed civilians. At least 18 civilians were killed, including two Reuters reporters and a man who tried to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured, and then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, cutting it in half. And that, Michael, provides evidence of three separate war crimes under the Geneva Conventions.
Marjorie, unfortunately, a lot of people who should be ardent supporters of Julian Assange are only lukewarm about him. He's been smeared as a rapist and even a cat abuser. Was this smear campaign a design of the Pentagon?
Well, the Swedish authorities launched an investigation of Assange for sexual assault, although that investigation has now been dropped. Criminal charges were never filed in Sweden. The Swedish prosecutor insisted that Assange travel to Sweden to be interviewed. He declined, fearing that if he went to Sweden, that country would extradite him to the United States. And the Swedish investigation of Assange may have been instigated at the behest of the United States. Journalist John Pilger documented political pressure by the U.S. government on Swedish authorities, writing both the Swedish prime minister and foreign minister attacked Assange, who had been charged with no crime. Assange was warned that the Swedish intelligence service, SAPO, had been told by the U.S. counterparts that U.S.-Sweden intelligence sharing arrangements would be cut off if Sweden sheltered him.
You know, the case against Julian, which has put him under confinement for a decade, involves many abuses of persons' rights. I wanted to ask you about some of these abuses. He sought and was granted political asylum by the Ecuadorian government, which granted him citizenship and residence in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was confined there for many years. Was he spied on there by the FBI, was he spied on by the CIA, even when he was talking to his lawyers?
Well, the Undercover Global Limited spied on him in the Ecuadorian embassy, according to the newspaper El País, and then delivered the audio and video surveillance to the CIA. This was an investigation El País did. Undercover Global installed microphones in several parts of Assange's quarters, using things like the embassy's fire extinguishers, and they also put surveillance systems in the embassy's female toilets, a place where Assange's lawyers would meet because they were afraid the conference rooms were bugged. And a streaming system was installed, which allowed U.S. officials to directly access Assange's meetings in real time.
So you mean that when he was talking to his lawyers, this was streamed back to Langley, Virginia, the CIA headquarters?
Apparently so, Michael. It's an outrage, violates the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and also the attorney-client privilege. Highly illegal.
That in itself would be enough to throw the case out, wouldn't it?
Well, generally it would if this was an ordinary criminal case, but this isn't because the U.S. government has made it into a federal, a big case. And I know that we're going to talk about that as well. And they just cannot abide having U.S. war crimes being exposed publicly. That's really what Julian Assange has been indicted for. Nothing else, just that, just revealing evidence of war crimes in 2010 and 2011, documents provided to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange by whistleblower Chelsea Manning.
When the progressive government of Ecuador changed and the right-winger Lenin Moreno took power, he accepted millions of dollars in loans to his government from the United States, and then he revoked Julian's citizenship and embassy protection. Please tell us about what happened to Julian.
Well, Rafael Correa, who was president of Ecuador until 2017, had granted Assange asylum in 2012 to protect him from extradition to the United States. And Ecuador's foreign minister at the time said that without this protection, Assange could suffer political persecution or extradition to the U.S., where he might face the death penalty. So the London Metropolitan Police warned Assange that if he left the Ecuadorian embassy, they would arrest him on a 2012 warrant that was issued after he failed to appear at a magistrate's court following his entry into the embassy. After living under a grant of asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for nearly 7 years, Assange was forcibly ejected and arrested by British police on April 11th of 2019, and Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, accused Assange of repeated violations to international conventions and daily life protocols after an anonymous source revealed the INA papers, which was a dossier that implicated Moreno in money laundering and contained personal photos of his family. WikiLeaks tweeted about it but denied any connection to the hacking.
Julian was falsely charged with computer invasion in addition to spying. The key witness in this later confessed to lying to the FBI about the whole thing in exchange for immunity. Tell us about the details of that, please, Marjorie.
Well, the first indictment that the Trump administration, keep in mind, let me back up. The Obama administration, which indicted more whistleblowers than all previous presidents combined, looked at the Assange case and considered it and decided not to indict Julian Assange because it would, in effect, criminalize journalism. And the New York Times and Der Spiegel and Le Monde and other newspapers had published these revelations from WikiLeaks. So this was called the New York Times problem. In other words, if Assange was indicted, then people from the New York Times and these other publications would have to be indicted as well. They were worried about violating the First Amendment's freedom of the press. So Obama did not indict Assange. Along comes Donald Trump, who did file an indictment against Assange, and the initial indictment charged hacking, basically, that he had participated in illegal hacking under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act with Chelsea Manning. Well, then the second indictment, which was called the superseding indictment, included 17 charges under the Espionage Act, and he could face 170 years in prison for that, and then another 5 years for the hacking charge. But meanwhile, the Trump administration realized that it was going to have a problem in convicting Julian Assange under all of these Espionage Act charges because he's a journalist. So they added a second superseding indictment, and that charged to bolster the hacking charge so that he could be portrayed as a hacker and not a journalist, so that there wouldn't be First Amendment problems. So the government's principal witness in the second superseding indictment to this beefed-up hacking charge was a man named Thordarson. And the Department of Justice had recruited Thordarson to build its case against Assange. But Thordarson, earlier this year, admitted to the Icelandic newspaper Stundin that he fabricated key allegations in the indictment in return for immunity from prosecution by the FBI in a quid pro quo. And the admissions of Thordarson that he lied about Assange being a hacker threatens to unravel the government's case. Basically, the indictment charges that Assange instructed Thordarson to commit computer intrusions and secretly record high-ranking Icelandic officials, including members of parliament, that they tried to decrypt a stolen file from an Icelandic bank, that Assange tried to use the unauthorized access given to him by a source to make use of a government website that tracked police vehicles, and that he had ordered and encouraged Thordarson to set up a relationship with a hacking group who would hack and illegally obtain documents to pass on to WikiLeaks. Thordarson has now admitted that all of these claims are either highly misleading or outright false.
Well, that's amazing. So now we have initially the CIA getting video streams of Julian talking to his lawyers, and now we have a completely stitched up charge of computer hacking that was cooked up by the FBI and Thordarson, who is evidently a past criminal, a child molester. He served a couple of years for that, and a fraudster who stole money from WikiLeaks. I think that that second offense with Thordarson would be enough to throw out the case as well, don't you?
Yes, it should be, certainly to throw out the hacking charge, and then the question is what happens with the charges under the Espionage Act. And what is happening now is a fight between the U.S. government and Julian Assange. The U.S. government is trying to extradite Julian Assange from the U.K. He's in prison in London right now. They're trying to extradite him to the United States to stand trial on this indictment that is charging 17 counts under the Espionage Act.
Well, there are now 18 charges against Julian. 17 of them, as you say, violate his First and our First Amendment rights. The position of the U.S. government is that he's an Australian citizen and therefore he has no First Amendment rights. Do you agree with that?
No, the First Amendment protects the freedom to disclose and the freedom to receive information. That right is shared by both the journalist and the reader, and he certainly does have First Amendment rights, even though he's an Australian citizen.
The lower court in Great Britain, under Judge Vanessa Beretzer, recently ruled that there was a substantial chance that Julian would find a way to kill himself if he were to be sent to a U.S. maximum security prison. A prestigious psychiatrist from Oxford testified to this, but now the High Court in London is reviewing her decision. Please talk about this.
Well, on August 11th, in a rare occurrence, the U.K. High Court's two of the judges on the High Court overruled the July 5th decision of another judge on the High Court and allowed the U.S. to add two additional grounds for its appeal against Assange. And one of those grounds is the testimony of psychiatrist Michael Koppelman. He's an international authority on neuropsychiatry. And Judge Beretzer, in her ruling denying extradition based on the high risk of suicide that Julian would face given the conditions he would be held in the U.S. prisons, she relied largely on the testimony of psychiatrist Koppelman, but not exclusively. She relied on other psychiatric experts who corroborated Koppelman's testimony. In her ruling on January 4th, denying extradition on the grounds of the danger to his health and life, Judge Beretzer wrote, Koppelman assessed Mr. Assange during the period May to December 2019 and was best placed to consider at first hand his symptoms. He has taken great care to provide an informed account of Mr. Assange's background and psychiatric history. He's given close attention to the prison medical notes and provided a detailed summary annexed to his December report. He's an experienced clinician, and he was well aware of the possibility of exaggeration and malingering. I had no reason to doubt his clinical opinion. And Koppelman had testified, quote, "I am as confident as a psychiatrist can ever be that if extradition to the United States were to become imminent, Mr. Assange would find a way of suiciding." Well, the United States, Biden, by the way, and Biden is continuing Trump's appeal, given the fact that the Obama-Biden administration had refrained from indicting Assange, as I said, for fear it would violate the First Amendment freedom of the press. But Biden is not following what his mentor Obama did, and he is continuing Trump's appeal and fighting to extradite Julian Assange. So what the United States is arguing is that Judge Baratzer should have excluded Koppelman's evidence or given it less weight because he admitted from his December 2019 report that Assange had a partner, Stella Morris, and they had two young children together. Now, Koppelman knew about them, but he was concerned about Morris's anxiety about the privacy of her children. There had been death threats against them, for heaven's sakes. And both Koppelman's subsequent report in August 2020 and his testimony at the September 2020 extradition hearing referred to Morris and their children. By then, it had become public knowledge. Now, before she made her January 4th ruling denying extradition, Judge Baratzer considered both of Koppelman's reports as well as his testimony. She acknowledged the initial concealment but excused it. She wrote, and this is Judge Baratzer, "I did not accept that Professor Koppelman failed in his duty to the court when he did not disclose Ms. Morris's relationship with Mr. Assange. In my judgment, Professor Koppelman's decision to conceal their relationship was misleading and inappropriate in the context of his obligations to the court, but an understandable human response to Ms. Morris's predicament. In short, I found Professor Koppelman's opinion to be impartial and dispassionate. I was given no reason to doubt his motives or the reliability of his evidence." It is well established, Michael, in English courts that the appellate court does not generally review factual findings made by the lower court, and that includes credibility determinations, because the trial judge is in the best position to observe the demeanor of the witness and decide whether the witness is telling the truth or not, and make credibility determinations. The judge was one of the two, the senior judge, who overruled the lower court's finding and allowed the U.S. to appeal this issue of Koppelman's evidence, the judge admitted that it's very unusual, quote, "very unusual for an appellate court to have to consider the position of an expert witness whose written evidence has been found to be misleading, but whose opinion has nonetheless been accepted by the court below." And he said there is not a complete bar to an appellate court finding that the judge below was wrong in her assessment of the evidence. "I have come to the conclusion that it is here at least arguable that the present case is one in which such a power may operate." So I don't know if he has any kind of political agenda or why he's bending over backwards, he and his fellow judge, to take this unusual step of allowing the U.S. to raise this issue on appeal. But it is alarming that now the U.S. is being allowed to appeal on all five grounds that it had requested.
We're speaking with retired law professor Marjorie Cohn. She's a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's on the Assange Defense Committee. She's quite well informed about the whole case. And we're going to talk now more about another situation with the British court that's even more alarming, I think, more dangerous than the psychiatric testimony. And that's that the United States government is now assuring the British court that if Julian is tried and convicted and sentenced to prison, he'll not be subjected to onerous conditions here, and that they'd keep him out of a virtual isolation. They'd even send him to Australia to serve his time. It seems to me that this is an even more dangerous situation than the one presented by the USA's bid to overturn the testimony of the expert psychiatrist. What do you think, Marjorie?
You know, I don't disagree with you, Michael. During the three-week extradition hearing in last September, there were several experts and officials from the U.S. prison system who testified that if Julian Assange were extradited and sent to the United States for trial on the indictment, he would be held in a maximum security prison in Florence, Colorado, the ADX maximum security prison. He'd be held about 23 hours a day in solitary confinement, which, by the way, amounts to torture. It can cause hallucinations, suicide, catatonia. And also that he would be subject to special administrative measures, or SAMs, where he would be, these are onerous conditions that would keep him in virtual isolation. The U.S. didn't contest that during the hearing and waited until the appeal stage to present so-called assurances, and I put that in quotes and I'll tell you why, that if Assange is extradited to the U.S., tried, convicted, and imprisoned, he will not be subject to these SAMs, and he will not be held at the ADX maximum security prison. And, as you said, the U.S. would not object to him serving any sentence he might receive in Australia. But these so-called assurances by the U.S. government are conditional. The U.S. reserves the right to impose SAMs or hold Assange at ADX if his future behavior warrants it. And the U.S. cannot guarantee that Australia would consent to host Assange's incarceration. The U.S. is arguing that Judge Bereitzer should have told them during the extradition hearing that she intended to refuse extradition based on Assange's life and health if he was imprisoned in the United States. And they say, well, then we would have presented these assurances at that time. But their current proffer amounts to new evidence that should have been submitted at the extradition hearing. There is absolutely no reason they could not have provided these so-called assurances during the extradition hearing when this new evidence that they're presenting could have been subjected to cross-examination in front of the trial judge. But they didn't. So that's also a ground that the U.S. is raising on appeal. And you're right, ultimately, that could result in the high court reversing the decision of the district court denying extradition.
Marjorie Cohen, regrettably, we're coming down to the wire here and approaching the end of our allotted time. But I wanted to ask you about the Assange Defense Campaign. What's it doing, and how can listeners get involved?
Well, I urge people to visit AssangeDefense.org. That's the website where there is information about the campaign to free Julian Assange, descriptions and articles about his extradition hearing, the legal issues involved, the political issues involved, etc. I work with the Los Angeles branch of Assange Defense, and I know, Michael, you also work with the Assange Defense team as the AssangeDefense.org organization as well. So I urge people to visit that website and get involved. And also, the corporate media has nearly blacked out the Assange case, even though it is probably the most significant First Amendment freedom of the press case to come along in recent memory. You know, when there is a development in the case, there'll be a small article in the corporate media, but it's up to Truthout, for whom I write, Law and Disorder, other alternative media sources to really get the word out. And there was an article in the New York Times, and I know many people wrote letters to the editor, and they didn't publish any, but I think that it is important for people to write op-eds, write letters to the editor, write to the White House, the Department of Justice, telling them to drop this case. Biden could dismiss it tomorrow, and that's what he should do.
Yeah, but I think the entire intelligence community, to use a euphemism, is behind silencing him, and I'm not sanguine about this at all. It's going to involve a tremendous effort by all of us to get him to do that. Marjorie Cohen, how can people follow your work?
Well, I do write several columns a month for truthout.org, and my column is entitled human rights and global wrongs, but also my website, marjoriecohn.com, marjoriecohn.com, is a collection of all of my articles, video interviews, radio interviews, and describes my books, etc. So I would urge people to visit truthout.org and marjoriecohn.com.
Last thing before I have to let you go, Marjorie, what's at stake here? What message will be sent if Julian Assange is extradited?
Well, the message that will be sent is that investigative journalists, national security journalists, publish information and material critical of the U.S. government at their peril. It will chill journalism, investigative journalism, because people will be afraid to print classified information, which is perfectly legal to do, for fear they will be indicted under the Espionage Act. So it has severe ramifications for investigative journalism and for the American public's right to know what our government is doing in our name in order to hold them accountable.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and we'll check in with you in the near future to report further on the developments of this extremely important Julian Assange case. Thanks again, Marjorie. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. You too.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.